Never mind. But all my efforts in meditation are just controlling. I saw some photos in my camera from the past and it feels there is nothing substantial to hold to. Can the right way to stillness be understood by know what doesn't work? But there's so many things which doesn't work. So it's endless finding out what doesn't work. And eventually one day this is what happens to people. They control, they try. And when we say let go, they try to let go. And it doesn't work because it's another type of trying. But eventually people get it. And I don't care how long it takes, it's worthwhile getting it eventually. And sometimes frustration is a good thing. Because when you're frustrated, you let go. They have all these wonderful stories and you're always a bit sort of reticent to tell these stories. And one of them was of this nun. And she was meditating for 7 years. This is in the Therigata. 7 years she had been meditating as a bhikkhuni, and she hadn't got one moment of peace. And she didn't want to disrobe, but there was no point staying on as a nun. So she decided to commit suicide. And so she took a rope, went into the forest, tied one end of the rope onto a branch, another around her neck, and was just about to jump off when she had her first moment of peace. She left it to the very last. It's a very dangerous, not to be recommended. But she really gave up. She let go for the very first time. And you've got the thing like of Ananda. He was the last person selected to go in this big meeting of all the monks in the Satipana cave after the Buddha passed away. 500 monks, they were all arahats except him. And they're going to a big meeting to collect all the teachings. And imagine 499 of your peers are all enlightened. You're the only one who's not. And that's just really, really just very hard to take. So he was up all night before the meeting, meditating and meditating and meditating all night. Never got enlightened at all. And when it got to dawn, he felt so miserable and frustrated. I've got to go to the meeting in an hour or two's time and look at me, just nowhere. And so he decided to take a nap before the meeting. And the story goes that just before his head hit the pillow, he became fully enlightened. Why? It's because he let go. He gave up. He gave up all hope. He let go totally. He had all of the causes together. He just needed to let go and he became enlightened. So you can imagine what it's like, those two cases. One, Ananda, being with the best teacher in the world for over 25 years. And then this nun, 7 years as a bhikkhuni, in the time of the Buddha with great teachers. They're trying, 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 and that was their mistake. The same as the Buddha's story. 6 years of effort, of trying. And getting so frustrated, trying everything, asceticism, wasting his body, trying all these different types, and then getting nowhere. And you can imagine the frustration there. And then just remembering, hang on, I did this letting go under the rose apple tree, and I got in this jhana. Maybe it's only, let's say, a 6-7-year-old kid. 7-year-old kids are not very good at effort. They're very good at being lazy and doing nothing. So that's, he used those abilities as a 7-year-old to let go. And just sitting under a tree, just doing nothing, just being there, and getting into a jhana. Now these should all be sort of indicators to each one of us, the path to enlightenment. No, it's not trying. It's letting go, it's stopping. And that's what works. So it is true that, sometimes there's a sense of sadness and frustration. Brilliant. You're on the edge of becoming enlightened. Now don't try that method with the rope. Dania, can you please lock away all the rope? But try the Ananda method. Go to bed. If it didn't work, have many naps every day. And that increases your chances of getting enlightened through the Ananda method. But the important thing is, this is now some of the stuff, and I still see even monks putting forth too much effort in their meditation. And they can sit for so long. But you ask them. And this was one of the strange things for me. For my fourth year as a monk, I spent an arranged retreat with this French monk. And he could sit for hours, you know, perfectly straight back, never any sign of sleepiness at all. And you know, always up early, meditate, just body never moved. And I thought, and like many other people thought, this guy's really, really close to getting fully enlightened if he's not already. And then I went somewhere else and I got the news he disrobed. And he left. And I couldn't believe it. And you talked to him afterwards and he said that, you know, sometimes in those all-night sittings we used to do once a week, he'd look at me and I was all slumped over, half asleep. And he was so jealous. He said, I wish I could do that. Because he was such a control freak. He held his body and mind so tightly. Yeah, he could not move, but he had so much pain inside of him. So much tension inside of him. And after 3 years as a monk, he couldn't stand it any longer, so that's why he disrobed. And that was one of the things which showed me that control freaks, on the outside, they can look very impressive, but they can't stay there very long. Because there's too much pain, too much tightness inside. And then the opposite, the ones who are just easygoing, who can let go, who can make peace with things, who don't fight, they're the ones who get enlightened. So, yeah, I mean, you get frustrated, but that's good. So now try something else. Let go. Don't try to attain anything. Ajahn Chah, we meditate to let go, not to attain. And so, I haven't said this yet, but you see on some people's t-shirts, on the back, make peace, be kind, be gentle. You got one there? No, sorry, no. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. And they, unfortunately, they say on the back, Ajahn Brahm. Now that is plagiarism, because that was said by the Buddha. That is the second factor of the Eightfold Path, right intention. And I'm really amazed that people actually forget. They're supposed to be Buddhists. They know the Eightfold Path and the Four Noble Truths, but they forget that when they're meditating. When they're meditating, they're trying hard. They're not being kind. They're not being gentle. Even to their body, I'm going to be sitting here for long periods of time. I'm going to beat down my body. I'm going to make war with it. Does that sound Buddhist to you? Beautiful, compassionate and kind. It's not Buddhist at all. It's not how the Buddha would meditate. So making peace, being kind, being gentle is the three aspects of right intention. Nekama Sankhapa, Vayapada Sankhapa and Ahimsaka Sankhapa. The three right intentions. This is where you direct the mind, where the mind is coming from. So your intentions are not to get something, to make peace with things. Not to try and change your mind, to get rid of your sleepiness or your restlessness, but make peace with it. To be kind to it. To be kind to your body. Opening the door of your heart to your body and to your mind, whatever's there. And be very gentle. And those are the three factors of the second part of the Eightfold Path, which leads to enlightenment. And sometimes that's where people make the mistakes. They don't forget about one of the factors of the Eightfold Path. And they meditate by making war. They don't make peace. They make war with their body and their mind. They're not kind. Stupid monk! Come on, get your act together. I'm going to get up at 2 o'clock tomorrow morning. That's not being kind. And not being gentle at all. Being so fierce. So, remember, this is the Eightfold Path, which is the path of enlightenment, and it applies to meditation as much as anything else. Some monks, they wouldn't hit a fly, but they'd hit you on the back with a Zen stick if you meditate. Isn't there something wrong there? And I must tell you the story, which is one of the funny ones, about when I was in Hong Kong, not this year, the year before, staying in a monastery which had monks and nuns, Mahayana, Theravada, Vajrayana. It was a wonderful place where any monk or nun could come and stay. And there was a visiting Zen monk from mainland China. And we were having breakfast one morning, you know, just gossiping about, you know, what was it like in mainland China with Buddhism. And he told us all made everybody laugh, that there was a Zen retreat in mainland China, and on the retreat the master sort of came around with a Zen stick, and he hit this middle-aged lady on the back with a Zen stick, which is their tradition, but she got out her mobile phone, rang the police, and had him arrested for assault. And the police had no choice, they had to take him to jail. Because you can't do that in China. Something, is it? The idea of a monk, poor old monk, I felt sorry for him, but you've got to be careful. Okay. Now, dear Ajahn Brahm, I'm just being nosy here. Next question. Oh, here we go. Why two cheeses and a chocolate? Why not two carrots and a broccoli if you could eat that for dinner? What's the explanation for that? Is there any? No, there's no explanation at all. Some things, the Buddha said, are unexplainable. So that's one of the unexplainable. You know, the other ones which are explainable, you know, the beginning of the world, the end of the world, and all of that sort of stuff. So that's, look, they draw a line somewhere. And we draw the line there. It's, you know, why is it that, you know, one part is Malaysia, another part is Thailand, and there's Malaysia, the Thai part of the border, there's Thais in the Malaysian part of the border. They've just got to draw a line somewhere. And it just happens to be a bit arbitrary. And why does something just fall on this side of the line and other things fall on the other side of the line? Who knows? I remember reading an article of this house. The border between Canada and United States goes right through their house, right through the middle of the house. And, you know, it's just some mistake of the people drawing the border lines years ago. And they will not move because they make the best of the situation. If the taxes are more high, in one part of the country, the house, they move to that part of the house, that's where they put their bedroom. If they change the taxes, they move their bedroom to the other side of the house. And that way. And the poor Canadian and US governments can't do anything about it. They don't know we're living in the United States. It's just, that's the Canada over there, just over here, but I'm now in the United States. And it's one of the same houses. But no, these are just lines, and they don't make any sense at all. Next question. Is our future predestined? I knew you were going to ask that question this evening. That was written in the stars. You had to write this question. Is our future predestined in accordance to our good or bad deeds of our past lives? If so, what percentage? How is it chosen? What family we are born into? It's not predestined because you are always making karma. Every moment you are changing your destiny. So much so that your destiny is in your hands. Your fate is right here for you to make, good or bad. It's in your hands. It's a wonderful thing to know that. It's very scary as well to know that you're making your future right now. In this moment, your future is being made. So it's how you deal with this moment is what makes your future. That's why when you come into the present moment and you get some mindfulness and awareness and kindness and wisdom, you can make wonderful futures no matter where you're coming from. Isn't that amazing? So do you choose your family we are born into? Well, you know, sometimes it's a sort of choice, but you know, have you ever like chosen the food at lunchtime? And it looks nice, and you realize afterwards, gee, this is awful. I've done that before. This looks very nice, and it's got some spice which I can't take. But it's a bit late then. It's like choosing your family. You know, sometimes they look nice, but be careful. Oh dear, what have I chosen? Dear Ajahn Brahm, how do we increase our wisdom to see that we are nothing and our compassion to see that we are everything in order to make this a world a better place? Thank you. A lot of people want to make this a better place, but they don't want to make themselves better people. They always try to change other people. So, if you increase your wisdom to see you are nothing, there's nobody in there, then you don't want anything. You don't need anything. Then all your energy and effort can go into helping other people. So when you realize you don't need anything, you're nothing, then you can donate all your money because you don't need it to the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. And then you make this a much better place. We can actually get some decent speakers. So that's how to increase your wisdom. No, I'm only just joking, messing you around. To increase your wisdom, this is what I mentioned yesterday, this is a deep point. We always think if we can increase our wisdom, then we can make this place a better world. And that was what Mara said to the Buddha. You know, try to stop him becoming enlightened. You can make this a wonderful world. But there's only so much you can do for this world. We try to make it a better world, and we really try hard. But it's always the same old problems. You know, the wars, the arguments. You know, we can't even just solve the wars in our own family. And how the threat we think we can solve the wars, you know, between nations. And so sometimes we have to realize that this human realm, according to Buddhism, is a realm of suffering and happiness. But you can't make it just a heaven realm. It's not the right place for a heaven realm. And indeed, the suffering which we experience here is really important for you. It's where we learn. That's why in my book, The Good, Bad, Who Knows, I mentioned an important point, the 70% rule. And this was where I was a teacher, and I had to set my first exam in mathematics, and I didn't know what to do. I asked a senior maths teacher, and they told me, don't make it too easy. If every child in your class gets, you know, 100%, then it'll be a waste of time. If every make it too hard and every child gets, you know, 3 out of 10, or the average is maybe 30-40%, then they'll lose their motivation. They'll come away thinking maths is too hard, we can't do it, and they won't like doing it anymore. But if you aim for 70% average score, then your class will be motivated. They will think they can do maths. And the 30% where they make mistakes, that's where me as their teacher can learn their weak points. So in the next few lessons, I can address those weak points, the places where they never understood. And that's where they will grow. And I realize that's not just with math exams, that's life. If you always score 100%, you never learn anything in this life. If you only score 30%, you get depressed, even suicidal, you want to give up. But if you score an average of 70%, then you'll be motivated. This is a good life. You're doing well. And the 30% of suffering where you make mistakes, that is where you learn. And that is so important. So this world is like a 70% world. A lot of happiness, a lot of joy, a lot of success for each one of you. But it will never be 100%. Otherwise you wouldn't learn anything. So that's how you increase your wisdom. Not to make this world perfect, but to be a place where we can learn from the difficulties of life. Dear Ajahn, what is your opinion about anxiety disorder? I don't know. Well, my opinion is, oh, please excuse me again, therapists keep on giving names to these things and say, you've got anxiety disorder, you're schizophrenic, you're ADD, whatever that means. And they put all names, and actually people live up to those names and they become those conditions. That's another part of psychology which is so well known. You know, if you put a person in a box, they live up to that box. They become that label, basically. And so that I'm very careful about putting labels on anybody to the point that you don't call anybody, you know, you are anxiety disorder, you are ADD, you are criminal, you are thief. Remember that story I said? I've been to many prisons in my life. I've never seen a criminal yet. I've never seen a murderer, never seen a thief. All I've ever seen is people who've done crimes. I've seen men who have stolen. I've seen women who have killed. But I've never seen a murderer. Just because they kill someone, does that mean they are a murderer? That's all they are? That word encompasses their whole totality? Of course it doesn't. We call a person a criminal. And because you call them a criminal, just because they did a crime, rather than a person who did a crime, you call them a criminal, they become criminals. That's who they think they are. And even this great story, which you've heard many times, but it's a powerful one. When I went to Singapore to the Institute of Mental Health to give a keynote address at one of their anniversaries, and I told the story which I just told you about, I've never seen a criminal, only people who've done crimes. One of the men, who was a professor at the Institute of Mental Health, asked me to bless his ward. And when I asked him, "Now, what is your ward? What do you do here?" And he was a professor of schizophrenia. And I said, "How do you treat schizophrenia in Singapore?" And he said, "I don't treat schizophrenia in a schizophrenia ward. Just as you mentioned in your talk, Ajahn Brahm, I treat the other part of the patient, which is not schizophrenic." And that was an amazing person who understood something for a change. If you just treat the schizophrenia, you're saying you're schizophrenic, and it gets worse and worse. There's another part of the person. Treat that. They're not a murderer, they're a person. Treat and respect the other part of that person, which didn't do a crime. And that part grows and grows and grows. And I asked him, just, and this is what he said to me. He said, "What?" I said, "What is your results?" And he smiled and said, "Much, much, much better than conventional treatments by treating the other part of that person." Isn't that brilliant? Anxiety disorder. If you think you have anxiety disorder, that's who you are, you'll never get rid of it, you'll be anxious and anxious and anxious. How about knowing there are many times when you're not anxious at all? You're a person who has moments of anxiety. There may be long moments. How about recognizing, being aware of, and cherishing the other part of you? And you will find what you pay attention to, what you focus on, is what grows inside of you. So that is the psychology of a monk who's understood his own mind for such a long time and practices that way. Treat the other part of the person. So if your husband is angry, he's not an angry person, he's a person who gets angry. Treat the other part of them with the part which is kind, and you find that will grow. What is sense of self? It is delusion. That's what it is. But it appears that you are here. But that is a misperception. When you assume things, you should always challenge them. Be a rebel. Who are you anyway? If somebody asks who you are, what do you write? You write your name. Come on, is that who you really are? Or you might write your gender. Is that who you are? Are you a girl? Are you a boy? Am I male? Look at the way I dress. I tell people you travel around. And sometimes you go to some countries and they don't write in English at all. And when I have to go to the toilet, I have to look at the signs on the toilet door and see which one is me. So that's a nice thing. When I was in Thailand, they had, it was really amazing. They had three sexes. Pet Yin, Pet Chai, and Samana Pet. That was the third sex. That was monks. And I thought that was really neat. You had three sexes in Thailand. Men, women, monks and nuns. Because we're outside of all of that. And I thought, wow, that's really neat. So, which one am I? So sometimes you think all this, and are you an engineer? Are you really an engineer? Give yourself another 20 years, you forget everything you've ever learned, so where's the engineering gone? You get dementia, you forget things. Is that who you really are? So we have all these labels, that's not what we are, but that is what we take ourselves to be, that's our sense of self. And that vanishes after a while. And even other stuff, you think you're a human being. You're male or female. My goodness, they keep saying men are from Mars, women are from Venus. You're not. You're from planet Earth. and we're all pretty much the same inside. So all these things which we take to be a self, that causes a huge amount of problems between people. I'm a Muslim, I'm a Jew. That creates wars when we think like that. So this is why the sense of self creates a lot of trouble with people. So when you realize you're none of those things, how on earth can you go to war with somebody else? I don't know who you are, I don't know who I am. So who's fighting whom? I don't know. I grew up thinking that the mantra Om is the most powerful of all. Is it true, really? How powerful is it? The most powerful mantra of all. And I haven't taught you this yet because I'm waiting until this part of the retreat, you know, to when you've got enough power. It's used to, when you breathe in, say to yourself, shut, breathe out, up. Shut, up. Now that's powerful. Shut, up. Shut, up. Shut, up. That is the most powerful mantra in the world. Can you do that? Shut up. Can arahats communicate with each other after entering parinibbana, or possibly communicate with the Buddha? No way. Because arahats, once they parinibbana, they're gone. There's no consciousness left. There's no mind left. There's nothing to communicate with. And if you talk to someone who's not there, who's going to listen? So this is craziness. So you're gone, you're gone. And okay, some people, you know, they say, well, you know, come on, Ajahn Brahm, give me a description. And the description, the best one, is in the Agivacchagota Sutta. This is where this wanderer, Vachigota, said, well, when arahats die, when they enter parinibbana, where do they go? And the Buddha answered with a simile. If there is an oil lamp, that's what they had in those days, but you may be better understand it if I say a candle. If there is a lit candle, and there is a flame, and the flame stops for one of three reasons. Either the wick is all burnt up, or the wax is exhausted, or the heat vanishes, a wind blows it away, then the flame stops. Because all the flame is the coming together of three causes. Wax, wick, and heat. When one of those causes disappears, only one of them, then the flame stops. And the Buddha asked Vachagota, he said, when the flame stops, where does the flame go? If it's been a good flame and made lots of good karma, does it go to the heaven realm where all flames live happy ever after? Or does it go to cosmic flameness, this unimaginable place where all flames can sort of exist but not exist, if you know what I mean? And I said, look, that's stupid. It just goes out, that's all. It stopped, it finished. And you know what the word in Pali is for a flame going out? Nibbana. That's where they got the word Nibbana from. So every kid in the time of the Buddha, when you mention the word Nibbana, they know what it meant. Because it was a word in common usage. It's just the flame is extinguished, that's all. And that's what the Buddha used for this human being. Once they enlightened and they get to the end of life, they're just extinguished like a flame gone out. But people say, but where does it go? Where does it go? If you can tell me where a flame goes once it goes out, then he can tell you where a arahat goes when he parinibbanas or she parinibbanas. How can we replicate some of the benefits that we've got from this retreat? It's many days yet. You haven't ended yet. You may die before this retreat finishes. And what do you mean, replicate these benefits? You haven't seen them all yet. Wait till the very end and then ask that question. You're way ahead of yourself. Be in the present moment, for goodness sake. So, but when you do go, how can you replicate some of the benefits that we've got from this retreat? Number one, get up at 4 o'clock. Number two, at 6 o'clock, do some chanting and go sadhu, 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 very loud so everyone in your apartment block can hear it. In the evening, had 2 pieces of chocolate and a cheese instead of dinner. And that's how you can replicate results. Come on, silly quick. How to change the fate if someone already works hard but still poor and sickly until now he's already 60 years old and still poor and sickly? Well, if it was just poor, you'd be talking about me. Because I'm over 60 years of age and I'm poor and I've worked really hard and I'm still poor. It being poor or sickly is not the point. You know, it's the nature of your mind, because some people are poor and they're incredibly happy. They're so content. And even some people who are sick and you wouldn't know it. And this is the most important thing, that even if you are poor, you can still be content. And that's the most important thing, to being content. And even if you are sickly, if you know how to deal with sickness, you can also be content. As the Buddha said, even though the body is sick, the mind does not need to be sick. Venerable sir, something, genetic research proposes interesting theories. About how a gene or a combination of genes are responsible for behavior and physiological symptoms and patterns. Junk genes consist 99% of all genes, and scientists have no firm explanations for the junk genes. Would samsaric karmic energy draw a parallel to genes? What do you think? That is very much like in science, in physics, dark energy. And physicists, they tell you that, 97% of matter is dark energy. In other words, they don't know what the hell they're talking about. 97% of that stuff is beyond their comprehension. And they still think they understand the universe. Imagine if you did an examination, you only got 3 out of 100. And that's basically what the scientists have got, 3 out of 100. The rest of the stuff, they haven't figured out what it means yet. And that's the same with genes. 99%, they call them junk. In other words, haven't got a clue what they do, if they do anything at all. So our genetics have only scored 1 out of 100, 1%. That's even less than the theoretical physicists. And they keep on telling us that they know what the mind is. They haven't got a clue what the mind is. 99% is incognito. And this is the stuff. And what else is there they don't know? Huge amounts. Some of the NDE episodes described in Pim Van Mommel, are dark experience, torture, pain, and not pleasant. Eh? Whether representative of the hell or the bad karma of the person, that's not the Pim Van Mommel ones I read. It must be another guy. But it's very, very rare. People who have near-death experiences, no, this is not hell. Usually near-death experiences are usually very beautiful experiences. So I'm not quite sure what book you've actually read here. When he says some of them are dark experiences, torture, pain, and not pleasant. Are you actually in the right book? Or are you trying to remember like past life memories? I think maybe people might be confusing books here. Because there are, when it gets to NDEs, near-death experiences, where you float outside of your body and then you come back again, they are just almost always very pleasant experiences. But I think you may be confused with people who go to hypnotic regressions to remember their past life. This is not near-death experience, it's past life regression. And some of those sometimes are unpleasant. And sometimes I teach people through meditation how to access your past lives. When you get into a nice peaceful state, to ask yourself or suggest to yourself, what is my earliest memory? Now you have to have pretty deep meditation, at least nimitta stages, and really good nimittas to be able to do that, even better just after you've emerged from a jhana. You ask yourself, what's my earliest memory? And if your mind is ready, just a memory comes up straight away, and you are back in that place and time, usually early time of his life. So to take it further, you just make the suggestion, earlier please. And that takes you even further back. And it seems to be the case that most people then remember the time in their mother's womb. Earlier please. And then you get your previous life. Now, what happens sometimes with some of the people who have done this, the closest memory to this life, from your previous life, is your death experience. That's the closest one. And it's also one of the most powerful. And unfortunately, it's usually painful and unpleasant. So a few of the students who have meditated under me, they say they've tried that, they don't want to do it again. Because they've got the previous life when they died. And so it's very easy to solve that problem. It's all you do, if you do get an unpleasant memory, through, if it's past life regression or if it's through this type of meditation which I teach, all you need to do is say, earlier please. So you know, go before your dying experience as something which is more interesting and a bit easier to handle. You don't have to just endure that unpleasant experience. And it is enduring it because you are right back there. You know, you're right experiencing those feelings as if they're happening right now. So it can be unpleasant. So you just say, earlier please, and then you go back to a much better experience. So if you ever try that, you know, don't miss the opportunity to access past lives and prove for yourself once and for all that this reincarnation is a fact. You know, once you do it yourself, you know, you don't need to be convinced by anybody. You know it's real. And to get to that insight and understanding, if you do get an unpleasant memory, just say, earlier please. That's all you need to do. And then you go back much earlier, and usually a much pleasant memory. So, but Van Lommel, he didn't really do that sort of work. Torture, pain. I can't understand that one. Ajahn Brahm. I know a lot of people said jhana is a very blissful thing to experience. There's not that many people get the jhana, so I'm not quite sure what you mean, but if you do get one, it is extremely blissful. But at this moment, I'm having my utmost blissful moments. Being in here, in your retreat, and having to listen to your Dharma talks daily, accompanied by great people around with great retreat accommodation. Right now, I'm still walking in the darkness color of meditation with a few shy lights that come to be dropped by sometimes. But when one day jhana will come to visit my best buddies, mind and breath and myself, we'll be welcoming them into our journey to walking together into our path. Many thanks, Ajahn. Okay, in other words, you're having a good time. So this is good enough. Well done. With that sort of attitude, you've got a really good chance of getting the jhanas. But if you say, oh, I've only got nimittas, I haven't got jhanas yet, this is not good enough. And I've got brilliant nimittas, but I want the jhanas, it's not good enough. But please be happy with whatever you've got. And the very fact you can live in a nice, peaceful, calm, joyful place. Just be able to go for a walk with no one to bother you and no one to tell you what to do is a beautiful freedom. So wherever you can find happiness and bliss in this retreat, take it. And eventually the big one comes, but just enjoy what you have already. Oops. This afternoon, this afternoon I was having the most wonderful meditation since the start of the retreat. The body was relaxed and I was enjoying a substantial period of observing the breath. I was putting more energy into the meditation with loving kindness to the breath, smiling and feeling happy. Suddenly, I heard a sound at the door and then someone marching into the hall. Then, bags being unzipped rapidly, and things being moved around in a rough way. Quite unusual things to happen in the meditation hall. I thought, could it be Mara that Ajahn spoke of this afternoon? I kept my eyes closed and continued to observe the breath amidst the disturbances. I only opened my eyes when I heard Ajahn's voice over the sound system. I saw the sound man and Ajahn trying to fix the sound system. When I walked out of the hall, I saw the time was 5:15 p.m. I was happy as a lark that Mara did not get me. Thank you. So you're okay. You survived. They understood it was just, as I said earlier, it's not the sound disturbs you. You disturb the sound system. So just try to fix this up to make it better. So usually 5 o'clock is when people go for tea time. So that's why I told Venerable Ji, if you want to try and fix up the sound system, come at 5 p.m. But you know, sometimes people stay and carry on meditating at 5 p.m. So sorry about that. But you did very well. You know, even though you were disturbed, you know, you didn't get upset and angry. Well done. If an old person gets senile, where is the mind, and can they still get enlightened? My mother had dementia for a couple of years. She didn't know who I was, even though I was the only person in the dementia ward dressed like this. She still couldn't recognize me. But when I went to see her the last time before she died, I went into the locked ward with my brother, and the first thing my brother said is, "Our mother's not wearing her dress. She's wearing somebody else's dress." And then he said, "Oh yeah, yeah, she does it all the time, and everyone does that, because when you lose your memory, you don't know what's yours and what isn't yours." Which means that when my mother saw a nice dress, she just put it on. When another of the residents saw one of my mother's dresses, she put that on. It was so sweet. No one had any sense of ownership. Wasn't that beautiful? You know, we have all this sense of ownership, what's mine and what's not mine, and all your shoes outside of there. You know, when you go out, if you see a shoe which, you know, you think you like, just go wear them. What's the big deal? See what ownership is, and attachments. So when you're senile, you don't have them. I thought, wow, I wish everyone was senile. So we have no sense of ownership. And so if you see a nice house, you want to go and sort of rest it, you just go into that house. You see a nice car, you want to drive, oh yeah, that'll do today. Just drive it. What a wonderful world that would be when we have no ownership. We could actually share much more. We wouldn't need so many personal things. Because, you know, people's cars, all your cars, they're locked away in your garage, not being used. They should actually be being used. If we shared it, all the stuff which we had, wouldn't that be wonderful? You know, some of your houses are vacant because you're out here, you're not over there. Wouldn't it be wonderful? You have a house there, it's vacant, and just someone can come and stay there. That means that, you know, that when you go back, you can go to another house, and you don't have to have the same old house. You know, one day you can stay in some nice areas in Beverly Hills, another one you can go to somewhere more cheap. Wouldn't that be wonderful, and you have no sense of ownership at all? And money! You know, you just, you know, not my money, it's our money, so, you know, somebody needs something. You use your credit card, use my credit card, anyone's credit card, as long as there's money in there, and when yours runs out, there's other people's you can borrow. Wouldn't that be a wonderful world? So I think the senility has got something going for it. You lose your sense of ownership and possessions, which is all based on memory. So you get some interesting stuff when you see people with dementia. But the worst thing with dementia, which I saw there, which, you know, is one of the reasons why, you know, that euthanasia, you know, when somebody else kills you, that is bad karma, that's too dangerous. But voluntary euthanasia, you know, there's a very strong moral argument for that when you have your choice to end your life. And what really sort of made me see that was, there was one lady, actually two ladies I saw in this dementia ward, who were in constant terror. You know, you could see in their eyes, I mean, you think anxiety, they were really terrified. Continually. Because they were literally waking up every moment in a place they didn't know, with people they didn't know. And they had no sense of safety, no sense of security at all. You know, here, you know, maybe you might be a bit anxious the first night you stepped here, but now you recognize the place, you recognize the people. Imagine you suddenly wake up and you don't know anybody, and you haven't got a clue where you are. For some people, that's absolutely terrifying. And that was their constant experience with every waking hour. And that was actually, when I saw that pain, I said, gee, that is this unacceptable pain. Which a person has.
And you can understand if you've ever woken up, which I have done sometimes, you know, in a hotel room or a monastery, you wake up, where am I today? And you haven't got a clue where you are. And you know, as soon as I recognize it, but you know, sometimes how scary that is. And people have that 24 hours a day. Anyway, Ajahn taught suffering type meditation. You teach letting go. Would you care to comment if there's any difference in the two methods, or is it all in the name? Taught suffering type meditation. Did I? No, I tell jokes, and maybe you call that suffering type meditation. But now I think what I did say is that there was a teaching which says when a person experiences suffering, just basically in their life at any time, you know, they realize that, you know, the Buddha understood this, and it gives them confidence in the Buddha's teachings. You know, that it's that saying of Ajahn Chah's, you know, joy at last, to know there's no happiness in this world. And that gives you a great sense of joy and happiness, inspiration. And from that you sort of let go of the world and become sort of enlightened. So there is, in a sense, of appreciating the suffering, and all the suffering eventually comes because you want something. So it teaches you to let go of wanting. And then when you let go of wanting, you know, the world is the world, but you don't ask from the world what it can never give you. That to me is the definition of suffering. It's the Four Noble Truths in just one line. Suffering is asking from the world what it can never give you. If you know what this world can give and you live within that, then you don't have to suffer. Buddhism teaches us how to let go, now to detach. At the same time, life is all about attachment between children and parents, between partners, etc. Is it not true that secure attachments are much easier to let go than insecure attachments? And if so, what can Buddhism teach about becoming securely attached? There is no such thing as secure attachments. Because that's the problem with attachments. They can go at any time. So that when we have children, what it can teach us is these aren't our children. It's when you put, that's my son. It's my mother. It isn't your mother. You don't own her. You don't own your child. This being comes into your life. Where they come from, you don't know. And there will come a time when they'll leave your life. You know, they'll just grow up and go and get married and live on the other side of the planet. You don't have them all the time. And this is one of the problems when we keep calling my child, my child, my child. That's where we get the attachment from. And we actually look upon it as, you know, almost like your property. So it's not your child. It's this being who we nurture, and then when they get to their age of independence, we let them go. We always love them and care for them, but we don't ever think of them as ours. And then we can actually enjoy our children without being attached to them. And it's the same between partners. You know, you find a partner in life and you live with them and you work, and if you can make it last, that's wonderful. But many people say that sometimes their relationships, they don't last. And a lot of people feel so guilty, as if they feel failures, they never made it last. Or they try and keep it going when it's really, really impossible and very painful for both. And there's sometimes there comes a time with the relationship, it's anicca, it gets to its use-by date. And there's nothing anyone can do about it. And that's where we have to learn how to part amicably, not blaming anybody. And it was just the use-by date has been reached. So we just have to accept that. It's impermanent relationships. So this is where we can enjoy, but then let them go when it's time to let go. And that's the hardest thing, to know when is the time to actually put more effort into a relationship and make it work. And when is the time when it's gone past the use-by date and it's time to let it go. But whatever it is, please, no guilt or blame. That is a real big suffering which people add to the end of relationships. Always blaming your partner or blaming yourself or blaming somebody. It's not, it's just nature, it happens. So this is how we can realize that all attachments, you know, are sort of temporary. And the nice little story which gives it a nice twist. Ajahn Chah would hold up a cup and say, "Can you see the crack in the mud?" And we'd always say, "No, we can't see." At least I said that when he first did this simile. He said, "Yes, you can't see it because it's microscopic, but this mug has a crack in it. Because one day someone will drop this mug or they will kick it and the crack will open up, it will break." He said, "That's called anicca, that's called impermanence, that's called fragility." And he said, "Because we know this is impermanent, that one day it will break, it's got a crack in it. Because we know that, that's why we have to be careful with it. We care for it, we don't sort of put it on the edge somewhere where it might fall off. We sort of put it somewhere safe and care for it, because we know it will break." He said, "That's the same with relationships. You know the relationships with your children, with your partner, with your parents, you know it's going to break. There's a crack in it. Because you know it's temporary, that's why we care. Why we care for our parents, we care for our children, we care for our partners, we care for our friends, we care for our own body. Because your body's cracked. It's going to break one day. If your body was permanent, to live forever, if your relationship, I'm going to love you forever, until the stars run out of twinkle, darling, I will always be yours." I try to be romantic, but it's very hard for me to be romantic. It just goes totally against my grain. But you say that way and you know, you're missing the point. When you realize that, darling, we're not going to always be together. You know, I don't know how long, but that's why I'm going to care for you. Because when you realize just how impermanent it is, that's why we care. So it doesn't make it negative. Some people say, "Ajahn Brahm, you're so negative, it's all impermanent. We're going to get married, we're going to get divorced, or one person's going to die, we're going to get separated sooner or later, what's the point?" The point is to care. "Dear Ajahn, explain Vipassana different from normal breath and insight meditation." Oh my goodness. Vipassana. Once, here we go, this is my story. Once there were this couple. Actually, they weren't married, but you know, they were living together. Vi was the girl, Vipassana, and her partner, Sam Atta. Sam Atta and Vipassana. Now, Samatha means like calm, like breath meditation. Vipassana means insight. So people always say about, are you doing insight meditation or breath meditation? Are you doing Samatha or Vipassana? So Vipassana and Sam Atta were a couple, they lived together. And one day after lunch, they decided to go for a walk up Meditation Mountain. And they decided to take their dog with them, called Metta, loving kindness, the dog. So Metta, Sam Atta and Vipassana walked together up Meditation Mountain. Sam Atta, he wanted to go up the mountain because it was so peaceful, it was so still up there. He went up there for the peace. That's what Samatha does, it makes you very peaceful. His wife, Vipassana, she went up there for the view. So she took her insight camera up there to take enlightening shots of the view of samsara. So she went up there for the view. And Metta the dog, what does a dog go up there for? Just for the fun of it. So Metta the dog went up there for fun. So Sam went up there for the peace, Vi for the view, the dog for the fun. When they got halfway up Meditation Mountain, oh, it was so peaceful up there. It was so still that Sam was so happy. And even halfway up Meditation Mountain, you could see for miles. So Vi had an insight camera, was taking all these amazing, amazing shots. And Metta the dog, you could see she was wagging her tail. The higher she got, the happier she was. And when finally they got to the top of Meditation Mountain, it was so still up there. Absolute jhanic peace. So Samatha was just so satisfied with the stillness on top of Meditation Mountain. Vipassana on the top of Meditation Mountain, she could see forever. The whole of samsara was laid out before her.
She was taking pictures of the Dhamma all over the place. And even though she was taking pictures, she could also experience incredible peace. And even though Sam was so still up there, he could also see the view. And little Metal the dog, she was wagging her tail so hard it was like falling off. You know what dogs do when they're happy, just running around in circles? That's what Metal the dog was doing. But even Metal the dog could see the view too and experience the peace. Because on top of Meditation Mountain, it doesn't matter if you go up there for the peace. It doesn't matter if you go up there for the view. It doesn't matter if you go up there for the joy and the bliss of it. Whichever one you go up there for, it's the same mountain and you experience the same things. Because on top of Meditation Mountain, it's bliss, it's stillness, and it's insight. The three live there together. So it doesn't really matter if you do Vipassana or Samatha. You're always doing the same thing on Metta Meditation. I prefer Metta the dog myself. Just adds fun all the way up. And breath meditation is insight meditation. If any of you doubt that, have a look at the Anapanasati Sutta 118, Majjhima-nikaya. There it says, anybody who does Anapanasati, meditation on the breath, fulfills at the same time the four Satipatthanas. So breath meditation is Vipassana. So said the Buddha. Anyway, next question. What is your perspective on mind-altering diseases or brain, such as dementia? I already said that. It's a great thing, so you don't have any property anymore. How should we look after dementia patients? Just being kind. And the interesting thing is that this is, I never saw this with my mother because I wasn't there when she died, but it's happened to many people. That if you are privileged enough to be with maybe your parent, they've had dementia, just before they die, they become clear. They may not have recognized you for years. And you're sitting by the bedside holding their hand, and they haven't recognized who you were for such a long time. And then just before they die, they say, Kevin, where have you been? Because at that particular time, it's been well known. The first time I saw that was in a short story by Leo Tolstoy. And it really stuck in my mind because he told this story of a person who was in constant pain 24 hours a day in some dasha outside of Moscow somewhere. And what the groaning and the screams did to the family in this house, because it was 24 hours a day. This guy was always moaning, screaming, in pain, and the family loved this person. They tried to get every type of medicine, conventional medicine, homeopaths, everything to try and stop the person they loved from screaming in agony for such a long time. It was driving them crazy. And then suddenly the house went quiet. He hadn't died yet. And he was lucid for the last 5 or 10 minutes without any pain, and then he passed away. And Leo Tolstoy said this was very common in the days before morphine, that just before people died, they had these minutes of no pain, great clarity. It was a time when literally their mind was separating from their brain. And that also happened with dementia patients as well. Or sometimes even people in a coma. The last few minutes or few moments, they come out. That happened to a girl who comes to Nolamara. She was with her sister by the bedside of her father, who had been in coma for quite a few days, holding the dad's hand. Death was going to come at any moment. And if you've been in that situation, you never know when. And sometimes you're waiting, 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 waiting. And I've been in that situation, just waiting on the bedside. And then it looks like they breathed out, and you think, they've gone. And then they breathe in again. You're careful of people and say, oh, come on. And finally they do it. And no in-breath anymore. That's how quick it is. But they were doing this and they were waiting, holding the hand, waiting for the last breath. And suddenly their dad opened his eyes. And he was laying on his back
leant up, look at his two daughters, and they said, without any sort of planning, they both said simultaneously, "We love you, Dad." And then he fell back and died. And it was just this incredible moment of clarity. Opened his eyes, recognizing his two daughters, been in coma for a long time, and then he passed away. And that is actually well known. It also happens in dementia. The last moments are clear, if you happen to be there at the time. Dear Ajahn Brahm, how do you make decisions based on thoughts, feeling, mind, when you know it is also anicca, not to be trusted? Oh, you just make a decision. So, when I was in Oslo, somebody asked me the same question, and there was a young girl in the audience, and I said to her, well, let's make the question a little bit more concrete. Suppose it's a decision whether I should marry my boyfriend or not. And, you know, that was the wrong thing to say because she went bright red, held her head in her hands, and turned around to the boyfriend sitting next to her. I shouldn't have done that. But, you know, you read her mind, got it correct, and bounced the hell out of that poor girl. Because that's a thought she wanted to, decision she wanted to make. She was contemplating, should I marry this guy or not? A really big decision in life. And so I told her the way to make such a big decision in life, should I marry this guy or should I not marry this guy, is to toss a coin. Heads I marry him, tails I don't. And then see how you react. That's a great part of the method. Toss it up, comes out heads. Heads I marry him. How do you feel? If you think, I'm going to try 2 out of 3. That means you don't want to. If it comes up heads, yes, then it means you want to. So tossing a coin is not to make the decision, but to reveal what you really want to do. And whatever that is, that's what you follow. And that's actually how you find out what you really feel you want to do in life. And decisions which are made like that are usually work out really, really well. Please can we have a ban on the use of mobile phones in this retreat center? People are talking just outside the dining room, in their rooms. This is very distracting. Thanks. Uh-oh, you're in big trouble now. Because if your mobile phones have been used during this retreat, your mobile phones make very bad karma. And your mobile phones will be reborn as parking meters in their next life. That's the worst level of technology for a mobile phone to be reported. Well, if you are going to use your mobile phones, please, you know, go a long way away. You know, at least to Singapore. Just go a long way. Don't do it outside people's rooms. Imagine they were just about to get into jhana and your mobile phone stopped them. That's bad karma for your mobile phone and you. Your mobile phone will be reborn as a parking meter and you'll be reborn as a parking meter inspector. So please, turn off those phones. Or at least if you use them a long way away, okay? Dear Ajahn, I have a lot of difficulty with emotions impacting my mood in the short term over the day and in the longer term over several months. When I sit down to meditate, I often feel a ball of anxiety in my tummy. I'm confused about whether to pay this emotion attention or not. I also find it hard not to want to get rid of it. Please share some Buddhist ways on how to helpfully relate to our emotions. There are good emotions which you encourage, like inspiration, like kindness, like generosity, like forgiveness. Those emotions are brilliant. Encourage those. Emotions like anxiety, they're the ones which are negative emotions, like anger, greed. So with anxiety, the way to overcome anxiety, I wrote this in my book, Good, Bad, Who Knows. All emotions have a physical counterpart. You feel it somewhere in your body. So with anxiety, it's usually in your chest somewhere. So if you have anxiety, find out where in your body the counterpart physical feeling is. Number two, know that counterpart feeling really, really well. The test I usually say is so you can actually write down on a sheet of paper and describe the feeling. Now, when you have an anxiety attack, what it actually feels like. Fill out a whole sheet of paper. Instead of saying, oh, it hurts, oh, it's tense. More detail, please. Because that means you really get mindful, fully aware of the physical feeling associated with the emotion of anxiety. Once you are aware of it then, take your hand and massage it. Give it some kindness, compassion. Because when you give it kindness, the anxiety or the physical feeling starts to diminish little by little until you stroke the counterpart feeling totally away. And then you'll find when the physical counterpart is relaxed away, the emotion behind it and associated with it will also disappear as well. And I've used that to great effect. For those of you who know Dr. Mukta, she's one of our committee members. She told me about a month or 2 months ago that one of her patients in hospital had severe anxiety disorder, which was so great she couldn't breathe properly. She had to be on oxygen. And this doctor gave her every treatment in the book, this medication, that medication, nothing worked. And one afternoon as she was leaving the hospital, this doctor tried this method, Ajahn Brahm's method, and just told this, you know, your daughter, good doctor, and that's a dad there, and told the patient, well, all these other things don't work, put your hand on the, well, where is the anxiety felt, the counterpart, and said in her chest, take your hand and massage it whenever you have this anxiety attack. And when she went to the hospital the next day, the girl was off the oxygen and said, I feel great now, can I go home? And this worked almost immediately. And all these other medications got nowhere. But she had to do that because that's what you're told to do as a doctor. But you know, the cheap method was the one which worked. So that's how every emotion has a physical counterpart. If you try and deal with the emotion itself, you're usually not skilled enough to let it go. But you know your body enough. If you've got fear, where is it in the body? Feel it, understand the physical feeling, and give it some sort of kindness. And when the physical feeling goes away, the emotion associated with it also goes away. Very lovely way of dealing with emotions. Ajahn, I'm blessed to be here. You share wisdom with fun. I have experienced relaxation and calmness that I can't recall. Oh, you've got dementia. I've got dementia. Sorry, I'm being silly. But you've got relaxation and calmness. Probably meant you cannot remember having it so good. I am content with what I achieved under your guidance. My meditation skills have improved vastly. I am happy and extremely blissed in wonderful natural sitting of retreat. Can I go home now? No, it doesn't say that. Whatever comes or does not come will be divine gift. I pay my gratitude and love to you. Very good. Another satisfied customer. But the best is yet to come. There's more days yet. I always experience wanting when the body disappears, wanting for nimitta jhana, which leads to restlessness, which leads to confusion, which leads to not having stillness. What to do? Just learn how to not want anything. Okay, important teaching in meditation. If that always is your problem, it's recurring again and again and again, please do this practice I call programming your mindfulness. So at the beginning of your meditation, you know, where you sit down, you know, you get reasonably comfortable, but before you get too comfortable, you say to yourself, when my body disappears, I will not want anything. When my body disappears, I will not want anything. When my body disappears, I will not want anything. In your own words, make a very clear instruction addressing the problem, repeat it 3 times, and listen with as much mindfulness as you can what you're saying to yourself. And then forget it. Because that's putting a program in your mind. And it works really well when you start, the body starts to disappear. Your old habit of wanting something is overcome by this instruction, which just comes from nowhere. It just bubbles up because you put it in at the very beginning. And that's a very effective way of dealing with problems in meditation, especially at the deeper stages. If when the body disappears you say, I won't want anything, that's more wanting and it just messes up the whole thing. It's just too gross to say things like that at that time. But if you put the instruction in at the very beginning, by giving yourself an instruction, simple, clear, repeated 3 times, which you listen to intently, you remember that. And when you get to that particular stage, body disappears, you won't need to do anything. The instruction's already there. and it works. Automatically, you don't want anything. Because you've told yourself, maybe 15 minutes beforehand. We call that programming mindfulness, and it's very effective, especially on the deep meditations. For example, you may get beautiful nimitta and then you get afraid. It keeps on happening. And if you get a beautiful nimitta and you try not to be afraid, then it all screws the whole thing up. It's too active. So at the beginning of the meditation, you say, when I get a nimitta, I will not be afraid. When I get that nimitta, I will not be afraid. When I get that nimitta, I will not be afraid. In your own words, clear, simple. It's amazing how well that works. The nimitta comes up, usually you've been afraid, but because you're given the instruction, the fear's not there. You've changed the habit. The deeper the meditation, the more effective that method is. It's very powerful. Ajahn, your CDs on meditation books and talks on YouTube has helped me to resolve difficulties that arise during this retreat. How do I sustain this momentum so that my stillness will improve further when I go back home? You haven't gone home yet. You may never go home. Who knows what might happen in the future, so please don't go too far in the future. What day is it today? Anyone know? No, it's the ninth day of the ninth month. 2000 and now, and it's now minutes past now. So please don't ask questions like that, because if you do, you're missing the point. You always be in the present moment. Don't you know the actor who you talked about in the morning was in the jhana before he came out? That's a very deep question. Don't you know the actor who you talked about in the morning was in the jhana before he came out? Oh, it wasn't an actor. This was just one of the members of our Buddhist society. I don't know if it was the morning. I think it was in the afternoon for a start. In the morning, was in the jhana before he came out. No, you can't be in the jhana before anything or after anything. So I'm not quite sure what you mean there. But anyway, that was the guy who was at home and just got into a deep jhana, was taken to the hospital. And you know, he knew he was, all the time he was perfectly aware, perfectly mindful. But you know, he was just blissed out. He didn't know where he was. The body had disappeared, so he didn't know location in space. He was just deep inside his mind. So he didn't know what the body was doing. Please explain the bad effects of alcohol, drugs to the mind. Also, how it would slow the spiritual path. Oh, crikey. You know, with the alcohol, it's very dangerous. And you all know, do you want another ghost story? You know the most dangerous ghost in the whole world? The bottle ghost? Liz? No, it's absolutely true. Now, sometimes people say, these ghost stories of yours, Ajahn Brahm, do you make them up or are they real? This one is a real one. I've seen this many times. This particular ghost actually possesses people. It gets inside of them and makes them do things totally out of character. And it even has killed people. That's why it's the most dangerous ghost in the whole world. It's called the bottle ghost, because it lives in bottles of whiskey, rum, beer. When you open the top and you drink it, you get possessed by the bottle ghost. It's one of the reasons they call whiskey spirits. And it makes you do crazy things. And if you're driving, it can kill you. And no, seriously, I've seen those alcohol do terrible things. One of the saddest funerals I ever did, and I've done many funerals here in Perth and other places, was of a Chinese girl, maybe about, I think, 20, 21. Beautiful young girl who had worked hard in mainland China, got herself a scholarship to study over in Australia, I think, after doing something over in China. And she just graduated. And her invited her parents over from mainland China to celebrate her achievement. Now, she just graduated. Her parents, poor people, sacrificed everything, you know, for their one child. The one child policy was a girl. And she'd made it. She'd graduated. And she was walking down the road in Kelmscott, just north of here, when a person who was drunk lost control of the car, slammed into her and killed her dead. And I remember her parents couldn't speak a word of English. Obviously poor. The whole effort of their lives into this one girl, and just some stupid drunk had killed this girl and basically taken away all these parents' futures and hopes. They were devastated. I mean, people say devastated, but like, this was real devastation. I've never seen anyone like that before or since. Just because someone got drunk and drove a car and caused incredible pain. So, you know, when I see things like that, people who drink, you know, sometimes it's really bad karma. Don't do that. You don't need it. And that's a bad effect. People say, oh, yeah, but not me. I only just take one or two drinks. And the old saying is, the man takes a drink, and then the drink takes a drink, and the drink takes a man. We all think we're in control. And that's the problem. We lose control too easily. So that's why, you know, the Buddha said, no alcohol, no drugs. It really slows the spiritual path immensely. Adambam, paradise is a place that you think you get everything that you like. Once you've got everything, then you need more. So you go to another paradise. It's never end. But Jhana Grove paradise is the end. Because you cannot have any more, because we won't give you any more. It is true, because sometimes that, you know, if you look at the paradises in the books, because I was really fascinated, you know, with the Christian idea of heaven, especially if you were in English. Okay, I was born in England. Heaven was this beautiful sandy beaches with palm trees and nice and warm. And then I read the Quran, and the Islamic idea of heaven, with beautiful green rolling hills, with oak trees and rivers. And I thought, all the Muslims want to get reborn in England, and all the English want to get reborn in the Middle East somewhere, with lots of palm trees. And ever look, that's what it actually said in there. Sometimes heaven is, you know, just what we think someone else lives in, and we've never actually been there ourselves. That's why I said earlier that many people in Perth, in the cities, they want to go leave it all and get close to nature. That's their idea of heaven. And all the farmers, actually people who live in nature, want to get away from the kangaroo ticks and the flies and go and live in the city where there's air con and you can get a good cup of coffee just downstairs. So our idea of heaven is somewhere else other than we are. That's what paradise is for us. Somewhere else. Until we realize that paradise doesn't exist. We go to somewhere else, we want to go to another somewhere else. So paradise is not somewhere else, it's right here. Do you know anyone alive today that is enlightened? If I said, would you believe me? If you believe me, you're gullible. So would you believe me? Then you're gullible. Who wouldn't believe me? Then it's not worth telling you. That's what Ajahn Chah said once. He got away with asking these silly questions. When they asked him, now, are you enlightened, Ajahn Chah? And Ajahn Chah said, if I told you, would you believe me? Because believing other people, you know, that's gullible. And he said, okay, I'm not gullible. I said, well, if you're not going to believe me, I'm not going to tell you. and that was the end of the conversation. So I get away with it the same way. Dear Ajahn, thank you for the excellent talk on insight. Today when I asked myself, what do I want, I realized to come out of suffering. I then saw that I had been feeling guilty for suffering and realized my stupidity. I became content with the suffering. And so it was replaced by peace. Brilliant. So be content with the suffering, and then there's no mental suffering anymore. It was replaced by peace. Contentment, acceptance and embracing all of the experience seemed like the heart of the practice. Yes, Thank you for your unconditional acceptance of your silly Dhamma children. Perhaps you could say a little more about contentment and unconditional love, or talk on it tomorrow. Excellent. That's precisely how it works. You don't fight suffering, you make peace with it. And then it just transforms into contentment. Can you please recommend any retreat center in Sydney or New South Wales? That place. Yeah, there's a few retreat centers over in Sydney. There's Wat Buddha Dhamma is over there, and that's, but it's a bit of a ways away. Ajahn Sucharta has got a group in Sydney, you can check him. And also, any English speaking retreat centers in Malaysia, Thailand, Sri Lanka, jeepers. I would like to practice as much as possible, of course. I will be coming to this retreat every year, if you can get into it. Do you know where Ajahn Yanadamo is nowadays? I know where he is, but he won't see me. But anyway, there's lots of nice centres. The best thing to do is get on the internet and then you actually find out, because there's too many to really say. Our Reverend Ajahn Brahm, since we are not going to get enlightened in this retreat, so why not let us rejoice in the outer retreat routine, such as a little chatting, checking text messages, chewing some nuts, and to refresh the mind with stillness for gaining insight and samadhi. Are all these not within the package of the Noble Eightfold Path? You are certainly not going to get enlightened in this retreat. So, you just keep on following the practice. So, forget your text messages, forget your little chatting, forget your nuts, and you will find that you may never get fully enlightened, but you get much closer, and that's good enough for now. So, please give it a try. Who knows? You know, it hasn't finished yet. You can do all the nuts you like when you go home, and you can check enough text messages when you go home. We offer dana to Sangha and donate for several causes of the needy people or living beings. Does this dana karma is part of letting go? Exactly, it's letting go. Because first of all, you've got all your attachments to your possessions. And we all know that sharing with others is the most wonderful way of actually having fun. And the old experiment, you give a person $5, they can spend it on themselves or they can spend it on somebody else. They always get much more happiness if they spend it on somebody else. So that's why you get a lot of happiness, because you're letting go. So, you know, doing a bit of dana is letting go, which is very, very good. That is why that really, that we don't have donation boxes. What do we have? Letting go boxes. But it's also important that those of you who do dana, do give donations, that you should know that your money is well used. So it's not wasted. Because sometimes, and if you give donations to people and they misuse them, you know, by just, you know, living high off the hog, you know, like some people actually do, and you give them donations and they live a better life than you do, then there's something very wrong there. I remember some Penang people, they complained to me because they invited some monks to a house dana, so they're giving food. And during the middle of the food offering, one of the monks' mobile cell phones rang. And he got it out and it was one of the state-of-the-art cell phones. Cost a fortune. And the people offering the dana said, "My goodness, this monk must be very rich. He should invite us to his house and give us food for a change. He's more wealthy than we are." And that was actually a fair comment. So, you know, if, you know, Sangha, monks or nuns receive any dana, especially monetary donations, it should be well used. So, you know, many of you gave a lot of donations for this place. And now you can see what it made. And so you can be sort of so happy that all your dana got to a good cause. It's not over the top, this place. But it's comfortable, and you realize that, you know, all of your generosity has been to a really good cause, and you can actually see it, you can feel it, you can sit in it, you can meditate in it. And you can also go over to Bodhinyana, all the donations over there, you can see where it goes to. So go and have a look in my hut. Go into my cave. and see just where the donations have gone to, so you can see how I live. So it's wonderful when with that open you can actually see what we do and how we live. And you really felt, wow, these are monks. You know, we live simply. And that means that you get so much inspiration that your Dharma has gone to a good cause. Some people say, but why should we give to a monastery? We should give to an old people's home or to a hospital or some other place. But sometimes, how much suffering, pain, disappointment, troubles have you overcome to stay by coming to this retreat? This is a hospital. It's a hospital where you overcome so many diseases and so many emotional blocks. The point is, the sorts of diseases which the monks and nuns treat are the ones you can't see. They're inside of you. They're depression, sort of fear, anxiety, lack of hope in life. If you've broken a leg, you can actually see that. If you're in a traffic accident, you can see them. So you can go into hospitals and you can actually see the burns being healed. But what you see being healed in a monastery or in a retreat center, you can't really see that. But it's very, very powerful healing. So that's why these places are like hospitals. Monks' monasteries, nuns' monasteries. And you benefit from these places enormously. That's why they're worth supporting. These explain living in the present and the need to plan for the future. You don't need to plan for the future. For example, if we had not planned ahead and registered early for this retreat, we would not be here by now. How do you know that? You know, there were so many cancellations for this retreat. So many people planned and they got a cold or something happened and never came here. So sometimes all your planning, it doesn't work. And anyway, if you know a few people, I shouldn't say that, should I? A lot of times that people plan and it doesn't work out, and sometimes they don't plan and it does work out. But don't plan too much. If you have time, I was going to do this yesterday, so I'll do it tomorrow. Time, please tell the story of the Australian man in the Himalayan temple and mystical sounds. I'll do that tomorrow, because it's getting late. Why was Buddhism almost wiped out from its home country, and why is it now the fastest growing religion in Western countries, including Australia and New Zealand? Because it was wiped out in India because of the Muslim invasion, basically. That wiped it out. And why is it now the fastest growing religion in Western countries, including Australia and New Zealand? One of the reasons is because it's spiritually very strong. And it hasn't got so much dogma, and believing in a god or believing in some sort of creation, which is so hard for people to accept. And because of that it's very acceptable for people who've got an education. And it does not discriminate against women, at least not in theory anyway, and we try the best not to discriminate against women or against gays or anybody else. So it's quite acceptable to the Western culture. It is democratic rather than authoritarian. We don't have hierarchies. We try and keep the rituals to a minimum, which means it's quite acceptable. It's a very modern religion. When I gave a talk about Buddhism in University of Western Australia about two weeks ago, they called me, you're very progressive. This must be progressive Buddhism. And I said, no, this is traditional stuff. This is what it was like at the beginning. So, is it progressive or is it traditional? Some people say, Ajahn Brahm, you're not traditional. Maybe not in the terms of what you know in Sri Lanka or Thailand, but what you see in Sri Lanka and Thailand is not traditional Buddhism. It's been culturally affected over many years. This is getting to the core of it again. So the core part of Buddhism is very beautiful and acceptable for modern people. That's why it's growing. Last question, because it's 9:30. There's another couple of questions here about some stories, but I'll tell these tomorrow. Dear Ajahn Brahm, sometimes when I do the breath meditation, my mind slips down to the 32 parts of my body and anicca. Most of the time I imagine inside my body and stops at bones and meditate on that, looking over and over at my body and imagine the skeleton of my body. This is the only imagination. No nimitta has come and see a dead nimitta. Now I see a dead tree where I try to composed my bones with the dead branches and that tree with some faded colour. Will this lead to insight meditation? Oh my goodness. Maybe I will get nimitta sooner or later as I practice meditation every morning for 2 hours or an hour at home. I will be patient maybe because I am a law graduate, ended up as a librarian because my father treated me with, so I'll be the first go to hell with, hey? My father threatened me that I will be the first to go to hell with professing of law. Look, being a law professor is not that bad. You don't go to hell just because you practice law. People have got a very low idea of lawyers. And some lawyers are very nice lawyers. They're very good lawyers. Many Buddhists are lawyers. And they're very nice lawyers. Okay, thoughts that are so stiff as the law that is blind. I don't understand the end of it anyway. But this is somebody who was meditating, and in some traditions they teach you to contemplate parts of your body. And they say 32 parts of the body. It started off as 31 parts of the body in the suttas, and the Buddha left out the brain, which was interesting. And they added the extra 32nd part in the commentaries, which was the brain. And that's just one way of looking at this body. The purpose of doing the contemplation of the body parts is to realize you aren't the body, it's just a body, that's all there is. So you lose a lot of attachment to the body. And the purpose for doing that is so that you can let go of the body, allow it to disappear and get into this realm of the mind. It's one way of doing it, but it's not really all that necessary. Because basically it doesn't usually work, even though you do contemplations of the body. I remember going to autopsies and asking the coroner who cuts up bodies every day, old bodies every day, cuts them up and examines what caused their death. And he says, you know, we actually asked him, please excuse the question, but you know, we asked him, you know, can you still have sex with your wife when you go home after cutting up a body all day? How can you get lust up? You know, when you just know what a body really is. And the coroner said, well, our pathologist said, well, I just compartmentalize. You know, I'm cutting up a body all day, but when I see my wife, you know, she's just this beautiful woman. And I don't see the body which is inside of her. Otherwise, I would not be able to have any lust. It's fascinating just when you actually ask these people what they're actually up to. So it was actually one of the... to see that even if you do go to autopsies, if you are a doctor, you know, you do tend to compartmentalize. You know, we know this is a body, this is all there is, but you get very attached to some bodies. And sometimes you say to your wife, you're the most beautiful girl in the world, I love everything about you. Do you really? Of course you don't love everything about them. If you squeeze her too hard, the stomach comes out at the very end. You know, the body is like a toothpaste tube. And what's in the middle of it, you don't really want to think about. So do you really love it? I love everything about you, my darling. Yeah, sure. But that's what we do to try and sort of get rid of lust. So if someone has got problems with lust, we do the contemplation of the body. But you don't take it that far, you know, you get sort of, you know, sick. And just think all bodies, you know, all people are just really just gross. And so some people get that way and it just goes too far. So it's a contemplation of the body just to be able to know it's just a body, that's all. So let it go. It's not a beautiful body, it's not an ugly body, it's just a body. There's great stories of in Buddhism. There was, I don't know if you know that one of the supermodels, it's actually quite a few supermodels are Buddhists. Kate Moss. She's a Buddhist, and she was on a retreat once, and this guy told me that he heard Kate Moss was on the retreat. And now she's a big supermodel. And so he looked around, just like you might look around here, which one is Kate Moss? And he looked around trying to see which one she was, and he couldn't see her at all. She was there, but he couldn't recognize her. Because it's only when you put all the makeup on, and all the airbrushing, that it actually becomes Kate Moss. The real Kate Moss, you know, the real girl is just plain looking, but she's got a face which is like a blank canvas and they can paint anything on it, which is actually why she's a supermodel. But in real life, she's as plain as anybody. It's fascinating to just know what we take to be beauty and why we have lust. All the lust and all the things which you think is really beautiful in the person is just added on. That's why we just look at a body. A body is just a body, that's all. That's why we do the body contemplations. Which means we're not afraid of losing it in death. We're not really sort of celebrating it. It's just a body, that's all. And that's why we do that for. But sometimes, you know, a person is doing that because they've been practicing like that. It's been their habit and it's not that useful. It's much better to stay with the breath and let the body totally disappear. So next time, whoever wrote that, if you just carry on watching the body, just go back to the breath. It's a much better place to go to. And just train yourself to look at this body as a bit of a distraction. But I do remember this one story because, you know, it was a tradition to do this in Buddhism, to go to places like autopsies. There was a couple of Bhante Gunaratana's disciples over in Virginia. And they, you know, they heard the benefits of going to an autopsy, so they rocked up at the local hospital and just tried to get in to see an autopsy. You just can't do that. And the people said, no, you can't get into an autopsy, you know, permission from this and permission from that. And so they tried to argue their way, no, we're just doing it as a contemplation, it's part of our religion, but no, nothing worked. So most of them went home, except for one of them, who hang out there. And he saw this guy come out of the autopsy rooms and started talking to him. And the guy just needed someone to talk to because he was going through a divorce and just, you know, wanted a bit of counselling. And the fellow, the disciple of Bhante Gunaratana, happened to be a lawyer. So he said, look, I'll do a deal with you. I will help you with your divorce papers for free if you sneak me in to see what an autopsy. And, you know, it's a good deal. So the guy said, okay. Now you help me with your papers and I'll sneak you in. So that afternoon, after doing the papers at lunchtime, the worker in the autopsy room snuck him in, you know, put the green cloak, whatever it is, on him. And he was actually standing around while they were doing an autopsy on this person. He was an African who had died. And as they were trying to find out the cause of their death, the cause of this guy's death, they were looking around and they say, oh, this guy's a piece of work because he's had many operations. Obviously been very sick and they've been trying to fix it and hadn't actually found out the cause. And then finally the doctors, you know, they saw the cause, said, this is the cause, and they said something in Latin, you know, as doctors do. And this stupid lawyer could not keep his mouth shut, as lawyers can't. And he said, oh yeah, that's cancer. And all the doctors froze and looked at him, because it wasn't cancer. It was the Latin word for medical malpractice. They made a mistake. And they said, who are you? You're not a doctor. He said, no, I'm a lawyer. Oh my God. Because they just admitted they made a mistake and killed this guy in the presence of a lawyer. And they got him out of that room as fast as they possibly could. And that's why they don't allow people to watch autopsies. Because a lot of times doctors make mistakes and they don't want anyone to find out. So that was the last time that Buddhists got to see an autopsy. So sometimes we do that and sometimes there's funny stories which happen. But it's great when you watch autopsies. I watch many autopsies, especially in Thailand, because you get in there very easily. And I remember this first this was in Sirirat Hospital. You know, you went into the room there, because you were a monk, you just walked in there, no security. And it's absolutely true. It was like a big lecture theatre, you know, with the seats going up. And on the windowsill, there was a plate. And on top of the plate was a severed human head. And a cut off of the neck. And I thought, this is a joke. It's just a plastic one or something. I went up to it and touched it. It was a real one. Instead of a flower pot, they had this real severed human head on a plate in the autopsy room. And being a monk, I thought, that's cool, that's awesome. So we really got out some interesting stuff as a monk in Thailand 40 years ago. So anyway, I shouldn't say things like that, otherwise you're going to have nightmares tonight. So that's the questions, except two, which are stories which we'll tell tomorrow. So, have a good night. And don't see any severed heads. Don't see anything.